Hi, I'm Sarah Nichols, founder of Nichols Law and host of The Women's Advocate. What does it mean to really advocate for yourself as a woman in a world that often tells you to stay quiet, play nice, and just settle for less? Whether it's your paycheck, your workplace, your relationships, or your health, we here believe every woman deserves the tools and the confidence to speak up, take up space, and build the life she desires.
What if compassion is your strongest litigation strategy? In today's episode, we're joined by an attorney who made that philosophy the foundation of her ERISA litigation practice, winning not just cases, but systemic change in how disabilities and benefits claims are handled. Our guest has a women-owned firm that brings heart to a rigid legal system, all while raising kids, leading national bar committees, and mentoring the next generation of lawyers. Cassie Springer Ayeni is one of the country's top ERISA litigation attorneys handling claims related to long-term disability insurance. And she's the founder of Springer Ayeni, a women-owned firm advocating for people with disability and life insurance claims. A frequent speaker and published expert, she's received numerous accolades and is a longtime leader in the American Bar Association's labor and employment law section, as well as a former governor-at-large of California Women Lawyers. She's award-winning, she's fierce, she's compassionate and committed to changing the legal landscape, not just for her clients, but for the profession. Cassie, welcome to the Women's Advocate.
Thank you. That was so kind. I really appreciate your words. Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Now, I know a little bit about ERISA, but enough to be dangerous. Can you explain what ERISA is and why it matters to our listeners?
Oh, sure. No problem. ERISA stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. And it's incredibly broad. It actually governs all employee benefits in the private sector. So originally, it was mainly designed to protect pension benefits, the Retirement Income Security Act. But that's evolved into all employee benefits. So it governs pensions, it covers health benefits, and the Affordable Care Act is part of ERISA. And in my area, it governs disability benefits. So typically, people, especially professionals, they go to an employer and part of their benefits package includes a bunch of different things that they may not even realize that they have access to. And one of those benefits is often long-term disability insurance. And that provides some measure of protection and income security if you become disabled and you can't work. And it doesn't have to be on the job disability or anything like that. It could be anything. My clients often have Parkinson's disease, long COVID, HIV and AIDS, SIR, chemo brain, fibromyalgia, ME/CFS, seizure disorders. I mean, anything that interferes with your ability to do your job can be disabling. So the typical scenario is that somebody can't do their job anymore. They realize they have this benefit. Maybe they call me to help with the application if they're kind of thinking it through, or maybe they apply on their own. And these are usually insurance covered benefits. So they apply to the insurance company, MetLife, Hartford, Unum, Prudential, et cetera, all these big names. And then their doctor says, you know, you need to stop working because of your disability and it's time and I support your claim. So they send in their application materials to the insurance company. And then the insurance company says, well, our doctor says you're totally fine. So get back to work. And then what do they do? You know, their doctor has told them not to work to protect their health. They need to stop working. And yet they're not going to receive their income because the insurance company has denied their claim. That's usually where I come in, is to help people appeal that decision and find a way to get their benefits in place so that they can get some income protection. And it's actually a really good benefit. Generally, these policies provide 2/3 of somebody's salary up through retirement age, usually age 67. So it can be a really important benefit for people. And it's critical to apply and to do it right and to not give up if an insurance company tells you no.
Right. Yeah, no, a lot of people, including lawyers, are not even often aware of what their employer might offer in terms of short-term disability policies and long-term disability policies. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's what we were chatting earlier about, you know, one of the things that people have a hard time admitting that is occurring in their body or in their life is a disability. For some reason, it's got this negative connotation as though it's some kind of personal failure, which it's not, to have, you know, something going on in your body or in your mental health that prevents you for a period of time or maybe indefinitely from doing your job. It's just a a matter of fact. It's a fact of life for some people. But I think that everybody going into a job, including me and you probably, think, I'm going to do this until retirement. Nobody ever thinks, I'm going to do this until I become physically or mentally incapable of doing it anymore. It's something about our culture, our brains oriented towards positivity or only seeing things in a, you know, in a rosy light when you're thinking about your future. And yet disability is far more likely to occur than death. I mean, people are pretty realistic about getting life insurance policies because everybody knows there's a risk you could pass away before life expectancy. But nobody even really thinks that disability is more likely, especially as you get into your later working years and you're in your early 60s. Disability can cause you to have to stop work early. That's what this is here for. But yes, people don't even realize it, even lawyers, that they may have this benefit available.
People, do employees, well, I guess I have a couple of questions. Often do employers have these kinds of policies, like long-term disability?
It's pretty frequent. It's actually one of the most frequently occurring types of insurance because it's relatively affordable premiums. And the nice part about these long-term disability insurance policies is because they're governed by ERISA, you don't have to go through a medical exam to qualify for these. They're group benefits. So an employer signs up and they're required to cover all of their employees as a group. And as a result, the premiums are not that high because the likelihood that a whole group of people is going to apply is very slim, right? So the actuaries at these insurance companies make those determinations. So I think when people are kind of looking at a package or HR department is looking at a package of what would be attractive to their employees or helpful to their employees, they think about providing long-term disability insurance. So it's pretty common, but it's not common in lower income workers, unfortunately. And typically these insurance policies are crafted such that it wouldn't even make sense to offer it to people who are not earning above a certain wage because there are offsets for all different kinds of money that you earn from different income sources, like Social Security benefit or state disability benefits and a variety of different offsets. So those offsets can effectively cancel out the benefit that the insurance company would need to make unless you're earning over a certain amount of money. So, but I would say that in most professions, you know, where somebody has gone to college and is working in a specific field, be it tech or law or medicine, nursing, construction, you know, things, well, that's not necessarily college educated, but things where a benefits package is part of why you're in that position, long-term disability insurance is likely to be there.
Right. And I know from working with you that, having clients that needed your assistance, that often there's just a denial of the claim.
Yeah.
And the individual needs help appealing it.
Yeah.
And just navigating that might require some specialist expertise and experience and just knowing how to present the information in the right way.
You're completely on track. So ERISA, because it's like technically part of the tax code, it's very nuanced and detailed. There are a lot of rules and regulations, and most lawyers shy away from it because it's the only thing I do because it's enough. It's broad enough that this is all I've done during my 23 years of practice. But one of these regulations is a very specific requirement for if your claim is denied, what you have to do, and then what they call it the plan administrator, which in these cases is the insurance company, what they have to do in response. So if your claim is denied, you only get 180 days to submit an appeal. And if you don't submit an appeal, then you lose your right to the claim altogether. So imagine if you're 40 years old and you applied for the benefits, you get denied and you just think, you know what, forget it. And you miss the appeal window, that 180-day window, you could have lost 27 years of benefit.
Right.
By not appealing. And the stakes are really high because nobody knows how long they could stay disabled. Some people recover and that's fantastic, but some don't. And in this appeal, another nuance of ERISA is that you have to submit all information that you want in the record because if you lose your appeal, your next step is to file a lawsuit in federal court and the court will not consider anything that wasn't before the plan administrator or the insurance company.
Right.
In most cases. Yeah. So you really need an expert to like tell you what to put in, and it's critical. It's a critical
problem. Right. And I also saw that, you know, and I can see this with other people I know who've gone through it, that typically you're going under some of the worst sort of situations in your life you've ever had because you're becoming disabled or you've become disabled and you're trying to get out of that. And it's just not the best time for you to be doing any paperwork. Usually you can't do your job. So you really need assistance in being able to like file the claim and file the appeal.
You definitely do, but it's tough because if you're used to being a very competent person, you know, you think that perhaps you are capable, have more capability to handle these types of things as you would have prior to a disability. But people who are in this situation that I see, like you mentioned, they're at this crossroads in life where their health is compromised. Potentially they're facing loss of identity through not being able to work anymore or the status of being a contributor or a financial contributor to their household, right? And then a financial crisis, potentially, if the insurance company is denying the claim, right? It's just so much going on. And so to offload a piece of that to somebody who can help you with the application or the appeal, to me, is a no-brainer. If I was in that situation, I would absolutely like hand it over to somebody who knows what they're doing. I do find, I don't know if you notice this in your practice too, that some people now with you know, ChatGPT and AI kind of taking over everything, think that like a little bit of bot-generated information is sufficient to do the job. And I can assure you that it is really not, because AI or ChatGPT, they don't know how to go through the nuance of the specific medical information or the details of your case. They don't know what a judge is looking for in order to prevail on the evidence submitted to the insurance company. So I would just caution people to not get too excited about ChatGPT being able to replace attorneys in a critical process such as this, especially when you've got years and years of income on the line. The stakes are just too high. You want somebody who knows what they're doing, not a bot.
Right. And, you know, I'm thinking a lot about how to train bots to do things, picking right cases for us and things like that. But, you know, I might spend more time on trying to train the bot than it's worth.
Well, they have their place, I think. I mean, they can, for rote tasks that don't require nuanced analysis, I think a bot can be fantastic, or for administrative tasks, right? Of like the business of running a law firm or something. But, you know, for the lawyering, that's what we're trained to do in law school and our whole careers, is to read between the lines, to find nuance, to find ways to get to a victory. And that's a uniquely human capability. And I would say unique to our profession, perhaps others as well. Maybe doctors have to do the same thing too. It's not just have this symptom, therefore your diagnosis is this. You have to look at the whole picture. And we're doing that as lawyers. And I don't think there's enough information we could upload to a bot, you know, let alone to keep it confidential, you know, as is our ethical duty, in order to get a bot to really understand and do have a nuanced analysis of a case. So, I mean, bots are helpful for some things for sure, but not for being a lawyer.
Right. Yeah. We need bots with like gut instincts.
Right. So, but they don't have guts. So
yeah, no guts on these bots yet.
No guts, no instincts.
That's right. Right. And then, you know, I think it'll be fun to play with some of those tools to see where they land. But it's just kind of a bit like their jokes. They're not quite nailing it yet.
And not quite. It's like slightly off. Maybe in time, who knows? But for now, no, I wouldn't trust it. Maybe to help you understand like what area of law it is, or a general deadline or something like that. But it's not going to help you win your case.
Right. And you've had quite a lot of success in getting denials reversed without going to court. What would you say has been some of the greatest approaches that you've used to do that?
Yeah, thank you for noticing that, because it's something I'm most proud of. And I think it's something that makes my firm unique. You mentioned at the start an approach that I take, which is trying to lead with compassion. And when I'm looking at my client, I'm trying to evaluate at all times what is best for this person in their particular life. And I don't think that losing a case in order to get it in front of a judge often suits the best interests of my client. It may suit the best interest of a law firm that wanted to generate more legal fees, but that's not my approach. And I wouldn't sleep as well at night if that was my approach. So I'm always trying to think what would help the client the most. And typically that is getting the benefits in place, that they have a monthly stream of income and they can have more control over their life choices and less stress about the financial worries. So our focus at the firm and as a team is to win those appeals without having to go to court. In court, you can get a settlement, like perhaps a lump sum settlement. You know, in a few cases, that might be preferable to a client, but it's in general, it's not because that's always going to be a compromise of some sort. If you get an outright victory with the insurance company before going to court, you're going to get 100% of the money that's owed to you.
Right. What the policy was meant to do.
The policy was meant to do. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we devote tons of time, not only to help the client, but also if we do lose, then we've built a really robust record that we feel confident litigating on so that we never feel like, oh, this case has to settle. I don't litigate cases to settle. I litigate because I want to win. I want to get what's due to the client. You know, right. The client wants to settle, so be it. But my goal is always to have a victory. So, right. So our approach is to, you know, talk to people, to talk to the client, to get their story. Often the declarations we take, because they won't have an opportunity if it goes to court to, you know, be in the witness stand. So this is their chance to tell their story, and they can be, you know, 7-10 pages long of narrative, you know, of us listening and writing down for the client to review what is their story, not only what makes you, you know, suffer from this disability, what makes you unable to do your job currently, but who are you as a person? You know, I'm amazed by our clients. They have these wonderful life experiences and tales of success starting from high school. And I want to hear it all. You know, I want to hear like, what made you this person who's so great at your job, who rose in your profession? And most of them are, yeah, I was a straight A student. I went to Berkeley. I did all these clubs. You know, I was so determined to get this job at, you know, X, Y, or Z. And I love hearing that. And I think it's cathartic for them to express it as well and remind themselves too that, you know, they have this rich history and their disability doesn't define them. It's just a moment in their life right now. So, and then I'll talk to their friends and their colleagues about what a great, motivated, strong coworker they are and how things have kind of changed after the disability, to their spouses. So we really try to get stories from a number of angles to demonstrate the credibility of our client and how this is somebody who always dreamed of having a long career, long profession, if that's the case, which it almost always is. Nobody ever anticipates, like I said, becoming disabled. And then, of course, we're going through all the medical records too. We're looking, there any tests that need to be done, holes that need to be plugged, trying to analyze it from what does the insurance company need to see to get to a win? And if they need to go to a test, we'll recommend that they go get one so that we can see what the result is and send it in. We can do, and you know, I've had some people, like I remember one person who has migraines and they're triggered by computer use. So I said, can we just do a video? You know, I'm sorry that to trigger, but like, can we just do a video of what that looks like? And it looked dramatic there. So, you know, we send in that to the insurance company. I mean, I'm just trying to think of all the things. One time somebody, she had chronic fatigue and it was like June or something. And she was telling me in her declaration, she's like, you know, my Christmas decorations are still up. That's how tired I am. I'm like, can you send me some pictures of your house and with the data on it? Cause I'd really love to just show that pictorial because it's compelling. I think to anybody, a claims analyst or a judge, anybody seeing that and realize, oh yeah, it's June. That is beyond the social norm of when we might take down our holiday decor. So this person must be feeling pretty tired, pretty ill to not be able to do that.
Right. And I think people feel, you know, a lot of shame and fear around disability and so want to hide. And it must be incredibly difficult to advocate for yourself in that environment or even share some of that information with your attorney. But I think unless you do that, you're not going to get the result you deserve. And that can be really hard for people to to do even with an attorney. So I think having the right, like the compassionate approach that you have with your clients, there might be some relief for them in being able to share it, even though it's hard.
I hope so. I hope that, I mean, I'm not a therapist by any means, but sometimes our conversations feel a little bit like therapy. You know, like my, some of my clients even joke around, this is my therapy telling you everything that's going on. And I appreciate that, actually. I'm grateful that they feel like they can be open and vulnerable to me. I want to hold that privilege very tenderly because it's hard for people to do. And it's a privilege when people feel like they can open up to me about what's going on in their life. And it's also best for their case, right? Because the more information I know, the better job I'm going to be able to do advocating.
Yeah. No, we just wanted to get, you know, part of the reason we're having this episode is not only do I consider you like an awesome, you know, peer and female firm owner, but just really getting a PSA, public service announcement out on this, because people kind of know they might need a will, but they don't really know about this benefit a lot. Especially when they're just in the throes of, you know, growing a family and trying to work at the same time and getting through all that. And I think when they look at their benefits, they're just sort of trying to figure out the change in their like basic healthcare benefit that might be changing every year as the employer is making cuts and things like that. And don't really understand anything beyond like maybe commuter benefits and some of the other things that people are still continuing to offer and should continue to offer. I think it's just really great. I started paying attention to my long-term disability when I started doing more extreme sports and injured. And so started to look at what my employer needed and then really think about, well, my parents would be on the hook for, you know, what would need to be paid in the mortgage and things like that, or just even my carers and stuff. So even went to top up the long-term disability benefit just so, because I know it's going to be enough just to look after me. I'd be a real difficult person with a disability, I'm sure. No one would want to look after me.
I'm sure you'd be fine, but it is, I mean, it's difficult. It makes people, it's life upsetting, but you're totally right. And it's great that you bring up that point about topping up, because that's something people might want to consider or ask a lawyer like me to do, is to look at the policy and say, you know, am I covered? Am I really covered? Sometimes these policies have a maximum benefit that is shockingly low in terms of a percentage of what somebody earns. Somebody approached me one time asking me to look at their policy, and it was a $6,000 a month maximum benefit. He was making $500 a year. But imagine going from $500 a year to $72 a year. I mean, that's a dramatic decrease. So in that case, you need to go try to apply for your own individual disability insurance as well, so that you have more than one policy.
Right.
I have a client right now who has 9 separate policies because he was a high income earner and the one policy wasn't going to support his family.
Right. Because your costs go up if you're disabled.
Yeah, your costs go up. Exactly. And your mortgage doesn't go down. So you need to be able to support yourself.
Right. I probably would have had less going out for drinks, but you know, whatever. I kind of, the caretaking would have been, you know, expensive. At the time I was single too. And so I didn't really know who was going to look after me.
Exactly.
You know, I'm not even sure my husband would want to look after me. So you just got to think of, it's just a lot. And people have
learned. It's a lot to think about. Yeah.
Hard to put on one person, even if they're good. So, you know, speaking of that, and just thinking about your life and what you want it to look like, how did you switch to starting your own firm?
Well, I wanted to be a mom. And honestly, that's the biggest reason why I did. I was working at a firm and looked around and saw what it was like and realized that it wasn't going to be possible to be the kind of parent I wanted to be and the kind of lawyer I was expected to be in a firm, which involved plenty of all-nighters and, you know, working well more than 8 hours a day. And I still work hard, don't get me wrong, but I have the flexibility as a business owner to set the hours according to what I need. If I need to go in for a class party, I don't need to clear it with anybody. I just go in and then maybe I have to work a little more when the kids are in bed, or usually it's before they wake up in the morning. But to have that kind of flexibility was, I thought, essential. And I wish that more traditional firms simply offered it, assumed that, you know, professionals are professional and they'll get their job done, because I think that's the best way to interact with anybody in the workplace, is you know, respect and trust. But it's just, I don't think it's really the case. So I was pregnant at the time. It was 2008. I was pregnant and decided that that was the time. So I opened my own firm with a law partner at the time. Now I'm a solo, as she left to have her own practice 9 years ago with someone else. But it was fantastic being able to have a young kid and have my own business at the same time. And I've now, I have 4 kids at home, and being able to have a large family and be a mom and not feel like I'm compromising at work. I mean, we always sacrifice something. Sometimes the kids don't get as much of me as, you know, and perhaps a non-working mom might be able to give. But luckily, my husband is a full and equal contributor to childcare, so that makes it possible as well. But it was just the best decision. So I would bring all of my babies into the office while I was nursing. And that was the policy for everybody who works in our firm as well. And even beyond nursing, I mean, my last son, I had him when I was 40 in 2018. And then right when he was ready, he was a really easy baby. So he was home with me for, it was 18 months. And so it was like, yeah, and he was great, you know, and he was my littlest. So I was a little like, oh, I'm not sure I want to send him to daycare. The rest of them, they were ready by the time they were like 11, 12 months old, but he just wasn't. And so, he stayed with me, and then I'm like, okay, I think he's ready. And it was January, 2020. So I put him in daycare, and then March, 2020, he came out of daycare with everybody. And then he was home for another year, but I was able to do that. Right. I mean, it was tough for everybody. And I had the other kids at home Zooming for school and everything too, like so many of us did, but being able to negotiate that with myself and my workload rather than having to clear it with somebody else was instrumental. And all of my attorneys on my team and my support staff as well, we're all moms. And I love being able to have a workplace that supports moms or any parents, but in our case, we're all females, so it's all moms, because I figure it, like anything that enables me to do my job is necessary for everybody else to do their job. So we have lots of flexibility. There's no questions asked if you need to, you know, take time in the middle of the day for this or that, or if your job is pickup or drop off, and so you can never do meetings before X time or after X time, that's totally fine by me. And I try to just work within people's hours. And even though we have an office, everybody works from home because it's just easier and they prefer it. And I'm completely fine by that. I don't know why it's so easy to do this, you know, to have an environment that's responsible to your team, that I don't know why everybody doesn't do that. It boggles my mind. Because I think it makes good business sense. You have less turnover and you have a happy work environment. Yeah. And it just makes sense for me personally as a mom and a lawyer. Yeah. Can I answer your question? a broad history of being a mom and a lawyer.
No, I think that's really helpful. I think a lot of different lawyers talk about it, or they say they're a mom, but they don't really break it down what that looks like. And they'll say my firm has been very supportive of me, but there's different ways of saying that that's happened and really breaking that down, what that looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's, okay. Yeah. Support. I think that in general, there's support of parents. Yes. You should become a parent, but does that mean that when you have an emergency, you're going to be able to get to your kid without a repercussion at work? I don't know. Does it mean that you're going to be considered equally for promotion or, I mean, there's a huge study. I'm one of the liaisons to the Commission on Women in the Profession, and there was this huge parenthood and child caregiver study in the legal profession. And it found that, I mean, just the vast majority of moms, as opposed to dads, because it surveyed dads as well, feel that they're deemed as not as committed to their work as dads are, or that they've been overlooked for certain choice cases or promotion opportunities. The numbers don't lie either. If you look at big law and how few women are still in equity level partnership, you can see that women are overlooked and underpromoted in traditional law firms.
Right, so, right.
Yeah.
We see a lot of cases where I've seen a pattern of this, particularly in tech companies, where they're offering very great, like good leave, lengths of time off.
Yeah.
And at the front end, employees are even saying, I want to grow my family while I'm here.
Yeah.
You're asking me to move from this company to this company, and I want to take off 6 months because that's what I would get if I was staying at my old company, and I'm going to have a second child or whatever, or I'm going through IVF. And at the front end, whoever's they're talking to is like, great, yes, we offer that. We can offer you the same. We'll match that benefit. And then on the back end, when the rubber hits the road and they're talking to their actual manager, it might be actually like, you're going to take all of that leave.
Wow. Like,
really?
So there's this subtle discrimination happening. Yeah.
So everyone, like you said, everyone wants to promote families. Everyone wants to offer the policy.
Nobody's going to say we're not family friendly.
Right. We'll hire you. But when the rubber hits the road, the person's out and maybe they're not responsive while they're dealing with a family crisis.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of employers forget that being a parent doesn't end when your child starts daycare. I mean, the number of times that your kid is out of daycare sometimes feels like it equals the number of days they're in daycare because they're sick or whatever. So you need to have an environment that understands that you have to work from home sometimes or pick your kid up in the middle of the day because they have a medical issue or medical appointments that only occur, you know, daytime hours. If you have multiple kids, multiply it by your number of kids, the time that you're going to need.
Right. Yeah. I can't imagine what that was like for you.
I mean, it's just this constant juggling act of scheduling appointments. And I've had to explain to all of my kids, I have the talk with them. The talk is, if you go to the front desk because you think you need to call me to come pick you up, there's a difference between little sick and big sick. Big sick, you go to the front desk. Little sick, we deal with it when you get home at night. Vomiting, pain, that's big sick. The rest of it, you fell down. I don't need to come get you.
That's right. That's right. I like that. Keep it simple. Big sick, little sick. Long-term disability, short-term disability. No. I think probably very refreshing for a lot of people to hear about this kind of law firm. And I think a lot of people are scared to start their own law firms because they don't know if they're going to be able to make it. And there's lots of ups and downs. And I think, you know, the first year can be tough figuring things out. And there will be ups and downs as you go along. But I would say for sure it's been worth it for me. And there's been lots of learning. And I think you learn more about yourself from doing it this way too.
And your brain grows in different ways because you're managing a practice and, you know, interacting with employees and all the things that come with it can be exciting and keep it feeling fresh rather than doing the same tasks day in and day out. But I think that, you know, it is hard to make that decision and have that confidence in yourself. And maybe particularly as women lawyers, if we've been underrecognized or underpromoted, takes a toll on our self-confidence. But I think that if you've developed some kind of niche expertise, or if you've, you know, just put yourself out there, you know, with the ABA or other communities to write, to volunteer, to speak, and you've developed a little bit of a name for yourself. Then you can take the leap and form your own firm and go on the faith and the trust in your fellow human beings that lawyers often really support other lawyers who go out and hang their own shingle. Because a lot of lawyers have that secret ambition, but they don't ever take the leap. But if they know somebody who does, they want to help you. They want to send you cases, refer cases to you if you have a little bit of an expertise, or they just want to mentor you or just be there for any questions you have because they remember maybe when they started out with their own firm. So just know that you'll be able to depend on your community of people who have done it before you. You're not starting fresh because lots of people have done it. And then just take the leap, I would say, if you feel like you know a little bit about an area of law enough to have some clients trust in your advice, you're going to get referrals and you're going to be able to start your business and you should do it.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that's really great advice and encouragement for people. And it's always surprising it's kind of one of the things that you delight in every week in just seeing who's referring you.
Yeah, it is. It's like, oh yeah, I haven't talked to them, but I did talk with them in detail at a conference where I remember they had some good questions when I was speaking and here we are, you know, It's nice to see, and you form these genuine relationships with people too. And then you just want to support each other and work cases to each other. Like you and I have. I mean, we became friends first, and then we realized that we really respected each other's work and started sending cases to each other.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if I met you before I started my own practice or not. I can't remember exactly, but
maybe you just had. I remember when we had our first lunch together in San Leandro. Yeah.
Because I had more time to have lunch, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Then when I was working for someone else, you know, I got to sort of say when I wanted to go do things like that.
It's true. And that's usually my prime networking time is lunch, because my kids are in school and I can just kind of enjoy a nice meal with someone I'm getting to know. And it's great, but you can make that choice for yourself. It doesn't have to be drinking or after party, you know, in the evening when I just want to be home and, you know, with my kids. It doesn't have to be these traditional cocktail things or after hours events. You can, when you're on your own, you can do it on when it's best for you, your schedule.
Right. Yeah. I definitely think that that's been one of the things that I've enjoyed. Like I can do it in spaces where I feel comfortable and excited to be, not some kind of place where it just doesn't fit my personality or wanting to be not in big crowds and things like that. I can really kind of pick that. So
yeah, and
I
also genuine that way too.
Yeah. Seeing how it connects all the different parts of your life at different stages. Like I'll get referrals from people I went to university with, the University of Sydney.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. In fact, the client I referred you was that through someone I went to Sydney with. Yeah. And so I think that just kind of makes it feel like a galactic practice versus a local practice when you
see
that connection come across in different ways and surprise you like that. It's delightful.
It is. I agree. That's great.
And also the other thing I'd say is it never feels like isolation, because no more so than being in a, you know, 13th story of a big office building working for a big law firm, because there are all these, like you get kind of, versus being in a firm, you get kind of chosen family. Like you get to choose who you connect with and what your networks are a little bit in a fun way.
Yeah. And it turns out that I enjoy networking the most with women. That's just, it's fun for me, you know, like we have, there's some more commonality there. And I love that I can sort of focus on that and focus even in my activities I do outside of just my job with the law firm. I enjoy women's networking organizations. It's just a lot of fun and it feels very genuine. And I feel like I can be myself. And when you feel like you can be yourself, I think it just comes across as authentic because you are being authentic, and then react to that in a way that's great.
What would you say is your superpower?
I'm really fast at work.
You're fast at lots of things if you have four kids.
I type fast. I read fast. I digest fast. It's a nice superpower to have. I know that I can get through editing a brief quicker than like most people. And I can write.
It is really like a superhero thing. They are fast too. So you really better pay with this superpower.
It's great, but it comes with expectation. This sounds a little braggadocious, so apologies, but I have to remember that not everybody is as fast writing or whatever. So in my head, I like to kind of maybe double the amount of time when I'm thinking about how long it's going to take somebody to handle something. That does come across braggy. So sorry.
It's delightful because you're not, when you take time with people, you take time. You don't have that
I can take the time in the conversations because I know I can get the writing done really quickly before my kids go.
It's kind of just delightful to me because I can see that in you, but I wouldn't have guessed that of you. I thought you were slow. It's just that I'm thinking about here's that superhero family where they all have like tights and like there's a dad and a mom and a daughter and Elastigirl and like all of them.
Right.
And the kid, the son, is like speedy. He can zoom around. And so that's you. You're
but with a typewriter.
Yeah. I love that. And, you know, it's not braggadocious and don't apologize for it and you didn't, but I'm glad that you didn't because we need to share our superpowers because it helps other people see their own, you know?
You're right about that. I hadn't always have sort of known that, but it's not something I really tell people because I can't imagine it ever coming across well. So thank you for asking because it's kind of fun to share.
Yeah, that's like a little secret. The work that you do can be really rewarding, but also really heavy because you're talking to people who are going through a tough time. What inspires you?
My clients inspire me. Mm. My clients with disabilities are some of the most amazing humans. Most of these disabilities are invisible, right? And so they're...
That's how they get denied, right?
They get denied. But they're going through daily life, you know, struggling to get to the grocery store and nobody sees it.
Right.
You know, but I know it because I've talked with them and I've read their medical records and they often even have a hard time. This is where I have to come in and maybe coach them. They have a hard time talking to their doctors about how limited their lives are because they don't want to admit it even to themselves.
Right.
So I see this just tremendous strength and desire to approach life with positivity, can-do attitude. And yet I'm asking them for my work. Tell me what you can't do.
Right.
And it's the shift and kind of it's really difficult for them to make that shift because a lot of them have been struggling for so long to keep working despite some real physical or mental limitations until they finally get to a point where they can't do it anymore. And I see that struggle and I respect it. So they inspire me because I see how hard they try and how much they don't want to quote unquote give in, but I don't view it as a failing. It's not giving in, it's taking care of yourself. So I try to, you know, encourage them to maybe see it a different way, but it's tough for people. People have a hard time when you're used to fighting, it's hard to quote unquote give up, but you're not giving up. You're changing something in your life so that you can care for yourself.
Right. And articulating that is powerful. And, you know, there's so many of us who want to make a difference in the world, but not always easy work. People want an easy feel good and they can get that, you know, on social media by, you know, I said this and I fought for this and I believe in this. But actually, you know, doing the work, extracting the information, articulating people's stories clearly when they're going through a lot is really powerful and can really help them on the path to not only recovering in their disability, but being able to create a good life with their disability.
Exactly. And get the care they need too. I mean, if you can go to your doctor and really be honest about things that are hurting and things that are difficult for you, your doctor is going to be able to care for you better, right? And the goal is always to help you feel better. And that may eventually result in being able to return to a job that you love. So there's really no downside in articulating the things that aren't going well in your body to your medical professional. And frankly, to me too, because then that helps me make the best case for you.
Yeah. So thank you so much for doing what you do and for helping tell those stories of people with unseen disabilities, because it's such a growing population. And I know a lot of our listeners know someone or themselves have something like that. So I just really want to say thank you today.
Thank you. Thank you for all the wonderful advocacy that you do. I really admire you and appreciate you. Thank you.
Welcome. So we've been speaking today with Cassie Springer-Ayani, ERISA attorney and founder of her law firm. Cassie, where can listeners connect with you or learn more about your work?
My website is www.benefitslaw.com. And you're welcome to look me up there, or you can call me at 510-926-6768. I'm at extension 1, and I'm happy to talk to anybody who's going through this or thinking about that they might eventually have a disability claim and wants to plan for it. I'm happy to chat.
Oh, thanks, Cassie.
That's it for today's podcast of The Women's Advocate. If you liked today's conversation, don't forget to follow or leave a review. It helps more women find this podcast and join the movement. Until next time, keep speaking up, standing tall, and advocating for yourself and others. I'm Sarah Nichols. Thanks for listening.